A surprise meeting between the top diplomats from Russia and the U.S.
It's probably not appropriate to call it a meeting, but perhaps an exchange.
Feisty words and not much diplomatic headway. Also today, migrant workers from North Africa are the backbone of Spanish farms, but their housing is makeshift and flimsy, and at least one work camp has been plowed under by authorities. That has raised suspicions.
Because it's very close to the road that goes to the tourist area where the beach is.
I'm Marco Werman. We also look at how technology has changed the ways China deals with dissent. And we meet a Cambodian rapper with lyrics critical of his government. He got a stern warning. My songs don't incite, he says. They just show listeners what's going on in their country. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it today. The war in Ukraine seems to cast a long, dark shadow over pretty much all of global politics. That was clear today during the Group of 20 meeting in New Delhi, India. This was a gathering of foreign ministers representing the world's 20 largest economies. U.S. and Russian officials exchanged angry barbs. Still, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did manage to briefly speak with his Russian counterpart on the summit sidelines. Karishma Mehrotra, the South Asia correspondent for The Washington Post, was there. Karishma, what was the mood today as these G20 leaders gathered in New Delhi?
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind here is that the ambiance across India, not just in Delhi, has been a lot of internal advertising around G20. So India has been really using this as a moment to put itself on the global map. It's been repainting old monuments. It's been putting up new structures. There's signage across the country covering Big Juhu Beach in Bombay and covering slums in Delhi. And it's mostly Prime Minister Narendra Modi's face.
I mentioned the exchange between Secretary Blinken and his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Is it fair to actually call it a meeting?
It's a tricky one. It was less than 10 minutes. So Blinken did request to have this sort of side exchange where he jotted down 3 points to Lavrov. One was about U.S.'s support for Ukraine. The second was the Russian decision to suspend its cooperation in START. And the third was Paul Whelan, the former U.S. Marine that's being held in Russia at the moment. But it was a quick one. And we don't seem to know if the Russians did respond in any way. The delegation seems to say no. And so it's probably not appropriate to call it a meeting, but perhaps an exchange.
Right. So hard to tell whether there was even any planning behind it. Does it suggest that there are lines of communication between the U.S. and Russia, or is that too hopeful of a take?
This did not happen in the last G20 in Bali, and Blinken and Lavrov have rare communication. So I think perhaps this is a sign that something new, but we'll have to keep watching to see what type of communication comes. But we know that this is rare and unprecedented. That much we can definitely say.
I'm curious, did the lines of support for Ukraine feel clear at this gathering, or did it feel kind of muddy?
I would say it still feels muddy, especially from the Indian side. I mean, in the press conferences, the Indian minister did not use the words Russia or China. They do sort of want to hedge this neutral positioning that they've been doing since the war began, which is that India does not want to sacrifice this larger historical relationship it has with Russia, its oil dependency on Russia, its military dependency on Russia. So there's a lot of interest that India is balancing here. And that has ruffled quite a few feathers in the U.S. as well, that India is not taking a more strident stand. And it seems like Global South countries in general are falling into this pattern of not having a very clear and direct language about the war that I think the U.S. would prefer to see.
When this G20 gathering began, Indian Prime Minister Modi called on world powers to focus not on what divides us, but what unites us. Was that the outcome, though?
Well, that's what they tried to make us focus on. The real thing to look out for is when the leaders come in September to India, will they be able to sign a document like they did in Bali? Will they even be able to use the template from Bali, as we've tried in these ministerial meetings, to say, yes, all countries agree on talking about the war in Ukraine? So we still have a lot to see when the top leaders of these countries come together in September in Delhi.
Karishma, if the outcome from this meeting doesn't bode well for the next big leaders meeting, the G20, later this year, what does that mean for Modi's image?
One thing that I think Delhi has been trying since the war began is they do want to be a mediator. And September is sort of an attempt to prove that. And I think losing the ability to prove that because they're towing the line too much between Russia and the U.S., I think it could mean perhaps the U.S. putting a harder line down and saying that this is not okay. But I think it's more of a missed opportunity than anything else. It's an opportunity where India really wants to show the U.S., like, look, I'm not siding with you immediately, but I can exist in between the two of you. And let me try and mediate between this and let me try and see where the overlap is. That is the test that we'll have to see whether or not it happens in September.
Right. That's the play. But is India's neutrality an advantage for the country, or does India feel like it's being squeezed between two powers, namely Russia and the U.S.?
That's a good question. And I really think that India at this moment feels like it's a strong advantage. And at the moment, being seen in a very strategically improved position. And the other thing that they're stressing often is that we're bringing the voices of the global south to the stage. And so they don't feel like they're being squeezed. They actually feel like they have the upper hand because the U.S. actually has not been very strong in their language against India's position in any way. They seem to be okay with India taking Russian oil, with India continuing to take Russian military technology, and for India not to be having extremely strong language against Russia. And so in many, from the Indian perspective, this actually seems like a strong geopolitical heavyweight positioning that they've managed to rally in this moment.
Karishma Mehrotra is a South Asia correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us from New Delhi. Karishma, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Stubborn global inflation is keeping food prices high in so many places. Let's look at one case, Spain, where much of Europe's fruit and vegetables are grown. But if Europeans see high prices on tomatoes, for example, they'd be wrong to blame the cost of labor on what they're paying. Migrant farm workers in the south of Spain are paid as little as $40 a day. Many of them don't have work papers and live in a kind of informal camp settlement, rarely seen in Europe. Jerry Haddon reports from the region of Almería, from a place there known by many as the Sea of Plastic.
It's called the Sea of Plastic because that's what it looks like from the sky. Mile upon endless mile of white plastic awnings, protecting watermelons and zucchini from the pounding sun and the wind. When the plastic wears thin, migrant farmhands find another use for it, protecting themselves. On a windy, chilly day, a young Moroccan man shows me. He won't give his name, which is common among these workers. They're suspicious of outsiders, afraid of being deported. He opens a padlock on a makeshift door, takes me inside a tiny hut, one of dozens in this hillside shantytown. His dwelling is just four posts wrapped in layers of that farmer's plastic. There's a dirt floor, two mattresses with blankets. These 60 square feet are for him and a friend, he says. For years, the man says he lived in another of the roughly 100 shantytowns in this area, informal encampments that sprung up when Almería's farming began to boom 20 years ago. It was called Walili, but in January, local authorities surprised residents by raising it. The police were outside, the man says, yelling for everyone to get out. They came and tore down everything, he says. We said okay and left, but I can't take it anymore. Officials said they demolished Walili because conditions inside were dangerous and dirty. It was a public health time bomb, they said. But activists and farmhands suspect Walili was more of a problem of public relations.
Why this particular shantytown and not another one? Because it's very close to the road that goes to the tourist area of Cabo de Gata, where the beach is. So it's the most visible of all of them.
That's activist Ricardo Perez from an NGO called Derecho a Techo, or Right to a Roof. He's with me in front of what was Walili. Now it's just a pile of rubble. Perez says farmhands would love better housing, but he says they have no voice out here and few allies advocating for them. Down at the beach, Pérez mentions, 15 minutes away, a local cafe owner, Antonio, says he has no sympathy for the laborers. It's a sensitive issue here, he says, so he only wants to give his first name. The government, he says, should tear down all the shanty towns. How can these people come here to Spain, he says, and then not want to pay for anything? They steal electricity, water. They just want to make a lot of money, he says, without giving anything back. When Walili was demolished, the nearby town of Nihat offered the 450 displaced residents temporary shelter here in an old warehouse in town. Outside, some young men kick a deflated soccer ball around a parking lot. There are bunk beds inside, but for just 50 people. A guard won't let me in, but a Moroccan man riding a BMX bike out front says this is not the solution.
23.
There are only 23 people left in the shelter now, says Isham Marawi. There's no work here. We're too far from the farms. The bosses don't come around here, he says, looking for laborers. By bosses, Marawi means the farm owners. They didn't respond to written questions about the conditions their workers live in. As for the rest of the Walili residents, activists say they took shelter with friends in other encampments. Most of the shanty towns, like this sprawling one called Atochares, are set back off the road, out of sight, out of mind, for the moment anyway. A fire tore through here in June, says Moroccan farmhand Abdella Skifi. I came rushing in from the fields, but it was too late. I lost everything, he says, my hut, my clothes. I even lost my dog. All that was left of her was some fur in the mud. Skifi is crashing in a friend's hut. He's been in Spain, he says, for 20 years. But like virtually all of the undocumented workers, he says farmers won't give him a contract. They tell him, he says, that they can't afford to, since the work is seasonal. Without contracts, the farmhands are stuck, earning about $5 an hour with no chance to move out of the camps. So for now, at least, they make the best of it. Back at the first shantytown, a young migrant named Morey is washing his feet at a trickling outdoor water pump. This is the poor man's bath, he laughs. Do you think the rich wash in cold water in the fields? Nearby, that young Moroccan man forced out of the Walili encampment when it was bulldozed, he sits atop a wobbly wooden frame, hammering makeshift beams to posts as the sun goes down. He's building himself a new, bigger hut. Just then, another migrant enters the camp, smiling. Hello, friend, he calls. He's pushing a wheelbarrow, practically running. This is for the walls of my friend's new house, he says. His wheelbarrow is piled high with white plastic sheeting. For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, Almería, Spain.
In every government, there's the person at the top, the executive generalist, then the cavalry of advisors who really know what's going on, experts in their fields, keeping the person in charge in the know. Yesterday in Romania, Prime Minister Nicolae Ciuca introduced his latest trusted advisor.
Dați-mi voie să oferim și un mic exemplu și să îl invit pe Ion să spună câteva cuvinte.
The advisor is named Ion, and instead of walking out, Ion just sort of appeared. Let me explain. Ion is an artificial intelligence assistant. Romania claims the first of its kind.
Salut! Mi-ați dat piață. Eu sunt Ion. Acum, rolul meu este să vă reprezint, ca într-o oglindă.
In a press conference, Ion greeted the Prime Minister and said, "You gave me life, and my role is now to represent you like a mirror." Physically, Ion looks and is the size of a dressing mirror, with a blue face floating mysteriously in the middle, speaking, and with word bubbles popping up as it talks. It's far from a toy. Prime Minister Ciuca says Ion's main task will be to scan social networks, then inform the government in real time of people's proposals and wishes. Romanians will also be able to chat with Ion on the project's website. In many ways, Ion sounds like management's ideal employee, reliable and always available. People in the world of tech security, though, are paying close attention. Critics say the public deserves a fuller explanation of what data Ion will receive and how it will use it. Just ahead, how the Chinese government uses technology to monitor protesters and the ways protesters are finding to subvert that effort. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When protests against Beijing's zero-COVID policy spread across China in November, many feared the government might respond violently. Back in 1989, the Tiananmen protests ended when tanks rolled into the square and soldiers opened fire. But as Dina Temple-Raston reports, more than 30 years later, China has traded tanks for tech.
Last November, a fire broke out in the upper floors of a high-rise apartment complex in Urumqi. That's in the far northwestern part of China. Almost immediately, videos of the blaze popped up on Chinese social media sites like WeChat and Douyin. At least 10 people died, and questions started to swirl as to whether or not residents had been locked inside the building as part of President Xi Jinping's zero-COVID policy. In order to keep COVID cases in China to as close to zero as possible, Xi had ordered mass testing, quarantines, and lockdowns that included actually welding the doors of buildings shut to keep people inside. And while Chinese officials denied that happened in this case, there was a general sense that what happened in Xinjiang could have happened anywhere. And so it sparked nationwide protests.
Xi Jinping! Xi Jinping!
They are going through the same process we went through 33 years ago.
This is Zhou Fengshua, and when he talks about 33 years ago, he means Tiananmen Square 1989. He was one of the students who led those protests. Back then, they all kept in touch by landline telephone and paper flyers. The regime, well, it communicated with tanks. And were you already on your way out when the tanks came, or did the tanks hasten your exit?
Definitely, they hastened our exit. We were the last group to leave, and I was the last one among the Tsinghua students.
He says these days the government doesn't allow people to gather in places like Tiananmen Square, so they've taken to gathering in cyberspace.
Now people gather in virtual community on Twitter, Telegram, and to some degree Instagram.
A few weeks before the fire in Urumqi, a lone protester unfurled anti-Xi banners on a highway overpass in Beijing. Among other things, he was protesting Xi's zero-COVID policies. Cell phone videos of banners on the bridge immediately popped up on social media, and China's censors immediately took them down.
Everywhere, every step is controlled. So they control everything.
What the leadership wasn't expecting was that the videos would reappear a short time later. People were using things like Apple's AirDrop feature to start to share them. Chat groups moved in to amplify the videos even more. And all this was happening under one of the most sophisticated censorship operations in the world. China employs algorithms and armies of human deleters to hunt down and erase countless posts every day.
The Chinese government, they don't give movements a chance to dig in. They don't like protest movements to build momentum. So they're very much into early intervention.
Robert Potter is the co-founder of Internet 2.0, a threat intelligence company. And he says people manage to find holes in the system and then exploit them.
It is a patchwork of systems set up individually that primarily act at their best at the local level. People shouldn't see this system as invulnerable or absolute and a guarantee against successful protest and policy change in China. But it also gives protesters a myriad way to slip through in ways that it can't be caught.
For example, it turns out that thousands of videos shot from a variety of angles is much harder for the censoring algorithm to identify than, say, a single one shared millions of times. If you flip demonstration videos on their side, the algorithm can't make heads or tails of what it is, so it doesn't censor it. Share a recorded video of videos? That confuses it too. The Chinese leadership had no control over the thousands of videos that began to get posted on Twitter and Instagram, so they pulled another weapon out of their digital arsenal, something called spam bots. Think of it as an army of zombie computers that inject irritating content into a feed to kind of change the subject.
They hijack the conversation about the protests in China and drown it out with distracting content. Not necessarily an alternative narrative, but just a major distraction.
This is Charity Wright. She's a senior China analyst at Recorded Future. And she was watching as these bots inserted themselves into conversations. One minute, you'd think you were going to get the latest from the protests in, say, Chengdu. And then the next, your feed would suddenly fill up with a bunch of ads for escort services or pornography.
Pictures of young Asian women with messages in the Chinese language. They were using hashtags, we call it hashtag hijacking, using hashtags of city names in China where the protests were breaking out, which then inserted that post into the conversation.
So in other words, someone would type hashtag Wuhan COVID protests, and instead of information about the demonstrations, they'd get a solicitation for sex. Full disclosure, Click Here is part of Record of Future News, which is an editorially independent arm of Record of Future. And while all the censorship and spam bots were working in full view, Robert Potter said China's network of cameras, facial recognition software, and tracking apps were hard at work behind the scenes.
And in some cities like Beijing, obviously, they're much more sophisticated than they are in other in further out cities.
But here's the ironic thing about that. The surveillance system they're using throughout China, well, they perfected it in Xinjiang.
Xinjiang, of all the places, is the place where the latest and the best usually shows up first. And what shows up in Xinjiang usually proliferates eastward across the country.
Rehan Asat knows firsthand about surveillance and crackdowns in Xinjiang. Years ago, Chinese authorities picked up and detained her brother Ekbar. He was accused of inciting ethnic hatred. And Asat said there was no indication that the authorities were targeting him. They just showed up one day out of the blue.
You know, you could be just like minding your own business, walking down the street, and a police officer would come to you just to make sure you were not one of the participants in the protest.
That appears to be happening all over China right now. Consider the case of 26-year-old Cao Jersin. She and three of her friends had attended a candlelight vigil for victims of the fire back in November. It was in Beijing. Last month, a video she made surfaced on the internet. If you're watching this video, she says, I've been taken away, like my other friends. She said she and her friends had protested peacefully. Now they're thought to be among the first people rounded up for taking part in the protests. Human rights organizations say that the police asked Cao and her friends about their book club. Apparently, they read a lot of feminist works, which Chinese officials don't like because they say it smacks of foreign influence. And reportedly, Cao was asked about her use of the messaging platform Telegram. It's blocked in China. Journalists and human rights organizations have been trying to publicize their cases. But what the detentions make clear is that China isn't turning to tanks to quell protests anymore. They're just having technology do it instead. For the World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the podcast Click Here, about the world of cyber and intelligence. You're listening to The World. Nigeria has a new president-elect. Bola Tinubu won after a surprisingly low voter turnout. A Nigerian writer tells us many young people there have turned their backs on the entire system.
They don't trust anybody in politics, and they've just opted out of participating.
Her latest novel is all about the choices young Nigerians make amid that tension. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's known as Havana Syndrome, a mysterious illness that severely impaired the lives of people working at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. Starting in 2016, many officials there reported suddenly hearing strange sounds, suffering from debilitating headaches and cognitive problems. Then cases popped up among U.S. Embassy staff in China, then Vienna, even Washington, D.C. Now an assessment from multiple U.S. intelligence agencies says there is no foreign adversary behind the mysterious illness. Adam Entis covered Havana Syndrome for The New Yorker since the first reports emerged. He's now with The New York Times. If no foreign adversary is behind this, Adam, according to these investigations, then do the reports offer any ideas about what is causing these symptoms among so many people?
There's a huge number here. We're talking about 1,500 suspected cases. There's no one explanation that they're giving for all of this. When they looked at these individual cases, they found a wide variety of potential causes. Some of them are sort of interesting, like, literally problems with HVAC systems in the SCIFs. These are the secure facilities that are at our embassies around the world, which are obviously used by diplomats and CIA officers overseas when they have any sensitive communications that they want to protect from eavesdropping.
Right.
So there's no single explanation. What the CIA and the other agencies are trying to do here is basically say they've searched hard, and they have not found any evidence in any one of these cases that they can tie to a foreign adversary.
Have you spoken with people who experience these symptoms about the latest assessment, and what are they telling you?
Yeah, no, I have spoken to a few CIA officers who were among those, and there's a lot of upset in that community. They feel like this finding suggests that they are suffering from or had suffered from psychogenic illness. So in other words, almost a suggestion when they heard that other individuals in their midst had become ill, they sort of started to experience them themselves. This is obviously very upsetting for them because they feel like it delegitimizes what they've gone through. And I've met with many of these individuals face to face, and I can say, they are not making up their illnesses. In some cases, debilitating issues that continue to this day. You know, that's what's so, you know, kind of frankly, painful about this assessment. But the impact that it has on people that have already been injured, this is sort of like another injury that they're suffering.
Of all the stories you've heard, Adam, from people affected by Havana syndrome, is there one that stands out?
It was a very experienced, military officer, somebody who spent time in war zones like Afghanistan. He's driving in a city in Asia that has a large Russian intelligence presence. And he has got his son, I think if I remember right, is 2 years old, in the car seat in the back of his car. And he's driving through an intersection and he comes to a stop. At that moment, he feels this intense pain and pressure in his head, and he hears the ringing sound in his ears, which is very characteristic of what was described by many of the patients who experienced this in Havana and other places. And at that moment, when he's going through this experience, his son in the back starts screaming at the top of his lungs, crying, inconsolable in the back, the exact same time he's experiencing it. And he guns it out of that intersection. And the minute he's out of the intersection, the pain stops for him and his kid is fine. And so I think that is a large part of this. The intelligence community just couldn't get to the bottom of it, right? They couldn't find anything. They would listen to what the adversaries, were obviously listening to their phones and reading their emails. And in those phone calls and in those emails, the adversaries are puzzled by the American allegations. They're not saying, oh, good job, we got those Americans. They're saying, we have no idea why those Americans are saying what they're suffering. And also, they're saying things about, this is an American plot.
Adam Entis has reported on the so-called Havana syndrome since the first cases emerged. He's a reporter for the New York Times. Adam, thank you very much.
That was great. Thank you for having me.
In Mexico, many say democracy is under threat from a new set of laws aimed at electoral reform. Critics say the legal changes will drastically undermine the country's electoral watchdog and make it more difficult to hold free and fair elections. The World's TBSi Zea has our story.
Tens of thousands of people crowded into El Zócalo, the main public square in Mexico City, this past weekend. Joining them were protesters in more than 100 other Mexican cities. Many of the demonstrators were wearing white and pink, the colors of the National Electoral Institute. It oversees elections in Mexico, and people call it the INE in Spanish. Don't touch the INE, people chanted. That's because last week, the Senate passed a law that will slash the agency's budget, undermine its autonomy, and limit its capacity to punish politicians who break electoral laws. That has caused a lot of anger. The INE was created in 1990, and it's considered to be a pillar of Mexico's democracy, says Lila Abed. She's with the Mexican Institute at the Wilson Center.
It is considered one of the most credible and legitimate agencies in Mexico. It was key in transitioning Mexico from a single-party rule into a more democratic system.
The Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, ruled for 71 years. That changed with the election of Vicente Fox in the year 2000. Lila Abed says people fear going back to the bad old days.
Presidents used to interfere and manipulate elections And the INE has been a staple of Mexico's democracy.
This institute is also in charge of training electoral observers. Mariana Campos, former head of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations, served as an observer herself.
And I have received training in my house. We're in charge of counting the votes at the end of the journey. We're in charge of taking those boxes back to the INE. The citizens of Mexico know that this is not a corrupt institution because they have been there.
But these new laws would cut 85% of the institute's staff. Campos says it's likely these trainings would end. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has long been critical of the National Electoral Institute. He says the changes will save millions of dollars and fix what he calls a corrupt voting system. But many of the president's critics worry that these laws are aimed at keeping his party in power. The Biden administration is expressing concerns, too. Brian Nichols is an assistant secretary of state, and he wrote on his Twitter account that, quote, "The debate on electoral reforms is testing the independence of electoral and judicial institutions."
¿Qué le digo con todo respeto? Que hay más democracia.
López Obrador reacted to the criticism, saying that there is more democracy in Mexico than there is in the United States. Mexico's Supreme Court is expected to hear a legal challenge to these new laws in the coming months, and it may strike some of them down. Mariana Campos says this will be a critical test for Mexico's democracy.
If we lose that, Mexicans will no longer have a certainty that our elections are fair, equitable, and trustworthy.
For the World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
In northern Greece, two trains collided late on Tuesday night. At least 55 people have been killed, among them many young travelers. This was the worst train crash in Greece's history. Immediately, public anger has been directed at the Greek government. Greek journalist Daphne Tolis has been reporting from the crash site and joins us from Thessaloniki. Daphne, what have investigators learned so far about what happened?
Investigators learned so far that the station master, which was arrested yesterday, he hadn't switched the line to avoid the crash that happened. There were two trains, one passenger train and one cargo train, were on the same line for 12 minutes before the collision happened. So the station master was arrested. He appeared before a prosecutor today, and he's given until Saturday to prepare his defense.
Right, and that, of course, led to a head-on collision. What does the crash scene look like?
The crash scene, it looked like a crash scene, basically, but there were cranes on site. It was the second day where the cranes were operating together with search and rescue teams from the Greek Fire Service and volunteers trying to lift the debris and the wreckage to find any possible bodies or body parts from the scene.
Many Greeks are angry with their government over this tragedy. Why is that?
People say here that this was bound to happen. It was a matter of time before something horrible happens, like a deadly crash. The infrastructure issues predated this crash. They also predated the financial crisis that Greece went through. But these problems intensified during the economic crisis that were in tandem with the austerity measures. So there were no extra staff hired. There was not enough personnel. People were retiring but were not being replaced by others. There was no training for any of the remaining staff. The actual station master, he was placed recently in this role. He was in a previous role before as 58 years old. He didn't receive maybe adequate training. There were not fallback measures in place to avert such a tragedy.
As a result of Greece's austerity measures some years ago, did the train system undergo any privatization?
It did undergo privatizations, but this didn't actually improve the infrastructure of the trains yet. All the automation, the station hasn't happened, all the mechanisms, these safe mechanisms to avert any tragedy like this.
So after this tragedy, Greek rail workers immediately went on strike. What does that tell us further about the state of the rail system there?
I think it's just telling us that they were not listening to their long-standing demands for hiring more permanent staff, for better training, for better safety, modern technology that's implemented. They were asking for that. The president of the Association of the Greek Train Drivers said that nothing works. There is no like central monitoring system. The light signals at some places, they don't work. The traffic control system does not work. They have been asking for that. They have been complaining, but they were not heard.
So what happens now? Are there promises from politicians that this tragedy will lead to real reform?
First of all, the promises that there is going to be a full investigation. The prime minister was on site on Wednesday, and he said, we will investigate this thoroughly. The transport minister has resigned. But it's a pre-election period as well. And this is something that also Greeks are kind of skeptical about. The promises that the politicians make now, 1.5 months ahead of the elections, that they're just promises for any possible voters, just to appease their ears. They're not really very trustworthy of that these promises are going to be kept, since this has been a long-standing issue.
Journalist Daphne Tolis at the site of the train collision in northern Greece that has left dozens of people dead. Daphne, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Last month, Cambodian rapper Kisokun was issued a warning by his government. Take down this song or face the consequences. The tune is seen as critical of the longtime ruling party. Reporter Ashley Westerman has the story.
Kisokun grew up in Siem Reap, the northwest Cambodian town known for the ancient temple complex, Angkor Wat. At first, he says he wanted to be a photographer, but then at 18, Kisokun changed his mind.
I've liked music since 2014, and I started to be involved with it in 2015.
Kisokun released his first single that year, entitled, in English, The Future of Trash. The song is about the life of an orphan. In this part of the song, he talks about the orphan searching for food in the trash, his stomach always hungry, and how he feels jealous when he sees other kids getting to go to school.
The music I sing is mostly related to social issues such as drug use, vehicle traffic, land and order issues, and culture. Issues of injustice in society.
Over the years, Kisokun has released several songs with titles such as Hidden Assassin, Sad Nation, and Solidarity. Then, in 2020, his song Khmer Land, Poor Nation, and People's Tears caught the attention of Cambodia's Ministry of Culture. Kisokun was arrested and convicted of incitement for his controversial lyrics, which, among other things, talked about opposing a dictator.
I served 1 year of the 1 year and 6 month sentence I was given. The remaining 6 months were suspended.
But when he got out, he kept writing. And in January of this year, he released the song Worker's Blood.
This song describes a garment workers' protest to demand their salary be raised.
The 2014 demonstration by garment workers was violently put down by police. At least 4 people died. The Ministry of Culture said reminding people of that incident could incite social disorder. Authorities forced the human rights group that posted the music video to take it down, and Kisokun was put on notice.
I didn't think it was a crime or inciting. The reason I composed those songs is to encourage Cambodians to love each other, to love their own country, and not become discouraged.
The government has a history of going after artists when they think their work is too political, says Varak U, the founder of the think tank Future Forum in Phnom Penh. Cambodia has been run by strongman Prime Minister Hun Sen for nearly 4 decades.
So it's not new, but it has been quiet for a while. Now it's come back, and so is the crackdown on that too.
U thinks the way Ki Sukhon uses hip-hop and rap allows his messages to reach a wider audience, particularly in a country where over 65% of its population is under the age of 30. U says not to count out Cambodian youth.
At this stage, they're not as visibly active as we think they should be. But I think overall, I think they're still active. You know, they want to feel proud of their country, of who they are.
The timing of Ki Sukhon's arrest is certainly not coincidental, says Phil Robertson with Human Rights Watch. Cambodia is holding general elections this summer, with Hun Sen poised to win yet another term.
We're not expecting that election to be free or fair, because of the government's systematic harassment of opposition political parties, the lack of an independent election commission, and the repression of independent media and NGOs.
And Robertson says Ki Sukhon's song about the garment workers struck the wrong note.
The government recognizes that garment workers are a mass of voters they need to win over, and so they're particularly sensitive to any sort of criticism about their labor policies.
As for Ki Sukhon, he says while he might lie low for a bit, he's not going to stop writing about Cambodia's social issues.
I believe in our society, and I chose rap to show our audience what is going on in their country.
For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila, Philippines.
In Nigeria, opposition parties are protesting the results of this week's presidential election. They claim that President-elect Bola Tinubu's win is a sham. The supporters of the Labour Party and candidate Peter Obi are especially upset. Obi was polling well in large part thanks to his popularity with young Nigerians, but he received just 25% of the vote, 12 percentage points behind the eventual winner. There's a new novel out from Nigerian writer Ayobami Adebayo, and it deals with how two young Nigerians from different walks of life see the dysfunction in their country as they try to find happiness. It so happens that Adebayo casts her story, A Spell of Good Things, against the backdrop of a regional election in Nigeria. Ayobami Adebayo joins me. Very good to meet you.
Thank you, Marco. It's nice to be here.
Your story is centered, as I said, around two young Nigerians. One is a teenage boy whose family had income but then falls into poverty. The other is a young woman, a doctor, who's having her own personal struggles. What messages and themes are you trying to get across about young Nigerians through these characters?
One of the reasons why the central characters are the young people in the novel, that I was also thinking at that time about what it means to be young in Nigeria and to experience all the systemic failures that are going on and to try to imagine a future for yourself in that. And that's one of the things that the young boy in particular has to process. What are the options that are available to him given the state of the educational system? And even the young woman who's a doctor and is just starting to practice medicine is coming into contact with a medical infrastructure that's barely there.
I mean, one of the major themes of your novel is how young people are kind of stuck. They feel pressure to get educated and make something of themselves. I mean, Eniola, the young man, certainly feels that, but they also feel pressure to adhere to family traditions. Do you think those themes are felt by a lot of young people in Nigeria?
I mean, the family expectations would vary from person to person and from family to family, but just the general sense that the government and the state is not working for them or working for their future, I think is one that many young people in Nigeria share.
In this week's real-life elections, the candidate favored by young people did not win. The candidate of the ruling party won, kind of the old school candidate. How well are the interests of young people represented among the powerful in Nigeria? And what do you think the consequences of that are?
I really don't think it's well represented. And by that, I'm not talking about how many young people are in government or how many young people are in the House of Representatives. I'm thinking in terms of the policy decisions, the percentage, for instance, of the budget that is allocated to education. Just last year, there was a protracted strike by university lecturers in Nigeria that I think lasted about 8 months. That doesn't indicate that you're prioritizing the generation of people who have lost that time, who were like waiting every month for the institutions to resume. There is no serious consideration and provision within the leadership for young people. And I think that's what many young people feel, that most of what they end up achieving, in many instances, they do it in spite of all the roadblocks in their way.
I'm speaking with Nigerian writer Ayobami Adebayo about her new novel, A Spell of Good Things. I mean, it seems for many people, politics is just a dead end for their problems. In your novel, at one point, your protagonist is spending time with a local politician, and his mother says politicians are, quote, the worst type of people you can associate with on this earth. That's the previous generation feeling that, and you're talking about young people feeling the same. So is that a commonly held belief among multiple generations in Nigeria?
I mean, I think that if I think back and look back, I can see in terms of as much of history that I've read, that almost every generation has a political moment where they become very disenchanted and apathetic, you know, about the politics in the country. And that's what the character's mother has experienced. They've just lost all faith in the system. And I think that, I mean, that's sort of reflected even in voter turnout many times, which is often very low. In many states, it's below 30%, sometimes below 20%. A lot of it is that many people don't believe that their votes will count. And even some of the people who do believe their votes will count, they don't trust anybody in politics.
Ayobami, one thing that really stood out to me in your novel is this passage at the hospital. One of the main characters is lamenting that there are not enough resources for patients. One of her coworkers is talking about how many young doctors are choosing to leave Nigeria. Do you think about that a lot, young Nigerians leaving out of frustration or for any other reason?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it quite a bit. Quite a number of my friends have left. You know, quite a number of people that I went to school with are no longer in Nigeria. I think my friends from secondary school, there's just one person. There's just two of us now that have a home in Lagos.
Wow.
It's quite a shift culturally. And I'm very concerned in terms of what we're losing in terms of people, in terms of skill, in terms of what will happen to institutions where the gaps have been left in hospitals and schools. So yeah, it's something that preoccupies me and I really hope something changes fundamentally enough for young Nigerians to feel that they have a future in the country.
So let me bring us back to Nigeria's next chapter. Given that Bola Tinubu is kind of a classic African strongman, trust me, my citizens, I have your back. What are your hopes about how Nigeria will move forward?
I mean, what I hope in the immediate sense is that things stay peaceful. I was reading that the Labour Party candidate has announced that he's going to take the case to court.
Peter Obi.
Yes. So in the immediate sense, how I hope that we move forward is that if these other candidates go to court, that there's a credible response from the judiciary that the country can trust in, and then we can move on, whatever the outcome of that is. So that's my immediate concern right now, that things remain calm and people can go about their lives and business without any threat of violence from any quarters. That's what I care about right now.
Ayobami Adebayo is a novelist. Her new book is called A Spell of Good Things. Ayobami, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
That is our show on this Thursday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. Be safe. Stay strong. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.
668. That's how many people donated to the World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 668 helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible donors right now. Reginald James, Jacqueline Tarrant, Rachel Elhus, Seema Kupchin, William Veronesi, Michael Jarman, Brian Smink, Lena Bjornson, Ethan Solomita, Adil Assad. And thank you to not only the 668 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done it without you.
From PRX.